Hello and welcome to the Starting and Operating a Successful Permaculture Nursery Summit, brought to you by the Permaculture Institute of North America, or PINA. If you support permaculture across the North American continent, then please consider becoming a PINA member today at pina.in. Today's summit is brought to you by PINA members and for PINA members. I'm Jesse, and I'll be your host for today's summit. Our next presenter is the affable Graham Towerton, presenting on the topic of starting a permaculture nursery from scratch, building your initial stock and propagation capacity. Graham Towerton's 30-year journey in permaculture began in rural Western Australia, where hands-on experiences highlighted the importance of community and sustainability. In 2021, he formalized his expertise by earning a permaculture design certificate, deepening his understanding of permaculture design theory. In 2022, he transitioned from a 34-year career as a chemical engineer to a full-time permaculture designer with Food Forest Abundance, completing over 30 designs and collaborating on many more. Now he is dedicated to helping families achieve self-sufficiency while developing his own property as a future demonstration and education center under the name Permaculture Adventures of Michigan. Welcome, Graham.
Hey, thanks, Jesse. Always a pleasure. Good to see you again.
Yes, likewise. And for people who don't know, we're both Michiganders here, so we've yet to meet in person, but that's bound to happen soon, and I look forward to that. I always like to start with asking the same two basic questions of everybody, because they often yield such interesting answers. So the first question is, what impact has permaculture had on your life and or livelihood?
An innumerable number of impacts. And so, you know, just trying to keep it short. You know, it's been part of my life now since the early 80s, starting on my parents' family farm in Australia. You know, we lost our shirts doing annual crops, and we started to look at, you know, what could we do differently? And so permaculture became one of the solutions for that. Mm-hmm. So from that early age in my teens, you know, permaculture has shaped my view of farming and gardening. I've been applying it on all of my properties that I've ever owned or rented, you know, in two countries, Australia and the US. Mm. And, you know, it literally shapes my life on a day-to-day basis now in many aspects, both here on my farm in Michigan and also in my business as a permaculture designer and landscaper. So it literally has become my life.
And you wouldn't have it any other way, right?
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't choose to do things differently, because, you know, permaculture, you know, just provides so many different facets, you know, not just in terms of plants and farming and gardening, but, you know, culture. You know, when the term was first coined as permanent agriculture, it then became permanent culture. And, you know, I see it now shape how we do things in communities, you know, interacting with other people like yourselves and different groups, you know, so it's a framework that you can use to, you know, literally live your life by.
Yeah. Amen to that. Thank you for that. That's a great answer. Next question and last question before I hand it over to you is, why the nursery business? What got you interested in that, or why do you find it to be necessary for you?
Yeah. So again, because I've grown plants for so long, it's, you know, it's a passion. It's in my blood. You know, growing up in farming families for a long time, and not just, you know, your traditional crops and conventional agriculture, but, you know, growing permaculture plants again on my parents' place, you know, so I learned a lot of skills, you know, about how to grow stuff, you know, over a long period of time. And so the natural progression of that is, you know, how can I use that to be a complement to my business and my farming activities? You know, quite clearly, as a landscaper doing permaculture landscaping, there still remains a shortage of plants for permaculture specifically. I think I've counted maybe half a dozen places where I can buy comfrey in North America, as an example.
Yeah.
And so there's still a need for production of more permaculture plants. And it's a great opportunity for me to improve the profitability of my landscaping business by not having to buy plants from others.
Yeah.
So it's a logical progression, a profitable opportunity. I don't know that there's much more in terms of business opportunities that are more profitable than growing plants. I mean, especially if you're looking at stuff from, you know, seed, or from starting from seedlings or small plants and growing them out.
Yeah.
It's a really good business opportunity still today.
Yeah. Awesome. I love it. And I agree. And we're really excited for your presentation. So I'll just pass it over to you. I'll be in the background here. If you need anything, let me know. Otherwise, take it away and teach us how to sort of start a permaculture nursery from scratch.
You bet. So, yeah, a little bit more background then. I've been a grower and farmer and gardener in three states of Australia, in New South Wales, Queensland, and Western Australia. Here in the US, in Texas, Oklahoma, Idaho, Florida, California, and Michigan. And I guess that's shaped or framed, you know, some of my knowledge about how to, you know, grow plants in a lot of different climates. So certainly within permaculture, you know, one of the first things that you're always doing from a design perspective is evaluating your climate and understanding, you know, what can grow, what plants are suitable for your region, for your bioregion, geographically, and, you know, what grows within your area well is framed by all of the things that you would do in sector mapping. And so I take the same approach then, you know, with nursery operations, you know, is understanding all of those things in order to determine what's good for me to have in this area. So quite clearly, everything that I'm doing right now is framed here in Michigan by the Michigan climate, which, you know, is somewhat unpredictable, especially at this time of the year, you know, where we can get warm weather in, you know, late winter, followed by cold in spring. That affects a lot of things, you know, like your apples and pears and peaches and plums in terms of cold climate hours, chill hours, etc. So, you know, understanding all of that information about what grows well is an important part of starting your nursery and then selecting the plants that you might want to grow. So I'm going to first start out by talking about what I think are good space requirements to consider when you're starting from scratch, and you don't really need a lot of space. You know, if you've got plants in pots or in seed trays, a couple thousand square feet is a lot to start with. For the first couple of years here in Michigan, in operating my landscape business, I started with just 500 or 600 square feet. So it doesn't take a lot of space. You know, this is something that literally can be done in your backyard. If you've got a smaller property in an urban area, you can still grow a lot of plants in that space, especially in containers, which is what I do for most of my my plants. They're potted. I do a lot of bare root stuff as well, but I'm usually sourcing the bare root stuff from others and then, you know, potting that up and keeping it in my inventory until I use it with my customers or on my farm. Again, looking at the habitat that's needed for your plants, you know, you're going to have different requirements in terms of sunlight, especially. So I like to recommend people should have some full sun areas for those plants that need it, some dapple shade and some full shade so that you can keep all the plants in their different habitat. And especially the younger plants, I like to recommend that, you know, you put those into some decent shade so that they're not getting scorched by the sun during summer and protected, you know, from wind is probably the other thing as well for your smaller plants. I also like to recommend that you have some way that you can protect your plants in the wintertime, you know, for the things that could be frost sensitive or aren't fully mature and might get killed if you leave them out over winter, even if they are a perennial plant. I like to recommend people have either a small greenhouse or the ability to put plants in their basement. I do a lot of that every year where I move my frost tender plants, you know, my citrus, my olives, those kinds of things down into my basement until they get mature. And then I can put them in bigger pots and keep them outdoors for those things that can handle the cold temperatures here. Probably the most important thing is the availability of water, because if you've got plants in pots, it's very quick for them to dry out. Seed trays, especially for things that you're growing from seed, your vegetable starts, those things are going to need water on a routine basis. So make sure that you've got your water available close at hand. In my case, I use rainwater. We've had 2 years in a row where we've had 6 or 8 weeks with very little rainfall through the growing season in the last 2 years. And so I've got about 3,500 gallons of rainwater storage, which I fill up in the spring with the spring rains. And that's usually good to cover the dry gaps. So I do recommend having, you know, both rainwater backup or, you know, some, you know, different ways that you can water. I've got my tanks located where they're uphill from my nursery and I can gravity feed through a hose to water my plants. And because I keep all my plants in a, you know, well-defined area, It doesn't take me a lot of effort to water those plants when I need to. I also recommend keeping a mulch underneath your plants. And what I'll do here, Jesse, is I'll just screen share now and just give some examples as we're going through. And you can see now, just what I'm using, for underneath my pots. I'm just using a wood chip mulch. This is great for keeping moisture in the soil and keeping nutrient within the soil. And when you're running a nursery, most of the states do require you to make sure you manage your nutrient runoff for nurseries. So if you're irrigating especially, they don't want a lot of nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium ending up in the watershed. So this is my way of managing that, is to just let everything be absorbed into my wood chip mulch. My organic matter in my soil was next to nothing when I first came here, probably less than 2%. And now I'm probably upwards of 15 to 20%, just as a result of 8 or 10 years of mulching and letting that rot into my soil. And that means now all my nutrient load from my potted plants ends up in the soil. And so then the next thing, again, if you're looking at it from a permaculture design perspective, is access. If we look at water access structures, the mainframe design, and apply that to a nursery, we've covered water. I've covered some of the structures like greenhouse and sheltered areas, but access is most important to be able to move in, out, and through your nursery. You're going to be moving plants on a regular basis. You may be dragging hoses like I do and moving materials in and out like potting mix, fertilizers, etc. So give yourself good access in and out and through your nursery. And this is also important if you're looking to have your customers come to your location and make plant purchases. They need to be able to walk through, see what you've got, be able to bend down and read labels like I'm showing in this one picture here. So with that, I'll stop screen sharing for a moment and I'll move on to the next topic about running a nursery, which is licensing and regulations. And every state, it's usually the Department of Agriculture that's going to have the primary say over the regulations that apply to you within your location. Sometimes you'll have a Department of Environmental Quality or a state-based EPA, which will also have some regulations you may need to consider, like the nutrient runoff thing that we just discussed. But most of your states don't require a license for selling annual plants if you're growing them within state and growing them from seed. But most of them are going to require some form of licensing and perhaps an annual inspection for your perennial plants. So using the examples of strawberries, they can get rust disease and mold and mildew, then the state inspectors are going to want to come and see how you're managing disease control especially. So some states will offer exemptions to that until you reach a certain sales volume or dollar amount of sales because you're considered low risk until you reach a certain point. Some of your states, most especially California and Florida, where they've got large amounts of agriculture that can be sensitive to disease. Both of those states have very large citrus and other types of crops that are subject to disease risk. They might require you to provide phytosanitary certificates in order to ship into their state. I think most nursery producers that I see don't allow you to ship into certain states, just to simplify that requirement, because it can be quite expensive to go through that process for individual plant sales. Next thing would be to be aware of plants that you're not supposed to ship or grow in certain states due to quarantine or state agriculture regulations. So there's a couple examples that I'll give here from Michigan. Chestnuts aren't supposed to be brought into the state, and you're not allowed to grow black currants. Both of these are of particular risk to large agricultural commodities in the state. So there is a big chestnut production in Michigan. And they want to prevent disease being imported that can affect those, because we've had problems with blight wiping out the original American chestnuts. So they, with the new hybrids that are being grown here, they want to protect against that disease so you can't bring chestnuts in. Then black currants is the other example I quoted. they can harbor the white pine blister rust, which then affects the large stands of timber production up in the northern part of the state. Plants that are described as noxious weeds. I made the mistake the very first year that I got here of planting some Indian mustard, and it didn't escape my garden, but it became very obvious the next year that I had lots of it that grew up from seed that had dropped to the ground. And then I found out by accident that Indian mustard is actually declared noxious weed in Michigan. So just give yourself a look at the agricultural website for your state Department of Agriculture. They'll usually list all the different plants that are noxious weeds and try not to grow those like I did. The next thing is propagation techniques. So I've started my nursery literally on the basis of buying potted plants at retail from other nurseries and marking those up, selling it to my customers, charging for the labor to install. And it ends up being very, very expensive for my customers, to purchase plants from me in that fashion. So in order to be, more cost competitive, propagating my own plants, is a thing that I continue to work on and learn how to do. So there's lots of different propagation techniques. Growing from cuttings is one that is relatively easy. So when you say prune a tree, I'll give the example of an elderberry bush, very, very easy to take cuttings of that, strike them in water, strike them in soil, and then have those, as plants that you can sell a year to 2 years later. So other methods include grafting, where you're going to grow your own rootstocks and then the scion or topstock trees and perform your own grafting. I haven't attempted that yet. I've just started setting up to do that now that I'm reaching a point of production for my farm and also for my customers where I'm going to need to have more grafted fruit trees available. So I'm probably going to start with apples. I've planted a lot of apple trees of different varieties. And I've got some crab apples that I can use for rootstock. So I'm going to be attempting that here in the next year or 2 years. And I'd suggest this is something that you probably want to wait 3, 4, 5 years before you start attempting this, because it does take some practice from what I've seen and learned. And, it's probably not something you want to start out with, when you've got so many other different methods. Growing from seed is probably the easiest, and that's the one that I started out with for a lot of my annual vegetable starts and also for some of my perennial plants, is growing them from seed. It's the cheapest way to grow anything, but it takes a little bit longer. I recommend starting in this fashion, for growing, the vast majority of your small understory plants, and then that'll give you a good profitable way to start and get into your business. You'll need to know the various techniques for improving seed germination rates. So there's certain varieties that need cold stratification, so it simulates the winter months that they would be dormant in the ground. And then another technique is scarifying, where you're scratching up the surface of really hard seeds. We had to do that with acacias in Australia as an example. Another method is air layering with these pods that you can wrap around the branches of a tree and create rooting within that pot. And it's kind of like doing cuttings without cutting the plant. Another method is ground layering, and elderberries and your brambles are great examples of plants where you can bend over the canes to the ground, cover them up with dirt, and then they'll root, and then you can separate them from the main plant, and then you've got another source of potted cuttings. And then the last thing I'd mention here with propagation techniques is for those plants that grow from seed, whether it's annuals or perennials, is saving your seed from your different varieties and planting them out for multiple generations and getting those plants then adapted to your local climate. So I've got a great example of this just with an annual plant. It's a cherry tomato that I first planted here in 2016. I've now grown it out 7 different times, and I don't actually plant the seed anymore because I've got so much of this stuff ends up on the ground on my property that I've got seeds which are just germinating and growing up in my mulch. And so I just transplant them from place to place. So that's a great example of being able to, you know, adapt your plants, whether it's squash, whether it's tomatoes, other plants, is being able to get them climate adapted to your local area. I'd say the same thing with all your different trees as well. And I'll move on to the next topic and explain, you know, why this is important as well with all of your other perennial plants. So where do you get your starting stock for starting your nursery? So as I mentioned earlier, probably the easiest way is to start from seed for growing your different plants. That's certainly the cheapest way to get into the business, where a few hundred dollars, you know, gets you all the seed you might want to grow for you, your customers, for a year or 2 years. But like I mentioned, also some of that can take a little bit of time in order to reach a level of maturity, especially if you're looking at some of your perennial plants. And I'll give an example with lavender. You can certainly plant that from seed, and it might take you 2 to 3 years before you can grow it out to a size that then becomes a potted plant that you can put out at a customer location. So what I do for sources of starting stock now, I'm using local and regional nurseries that grow their plants in their location. And the reason for that is because they're going to generally be climate adapted. I have a preference for trying to find folks that are growing varieties that are disease resistant within my area. So I've got a great little shout out here for Trio Permaculture, which is T-R-E-E-Y-O Permaculture. And that's Doug Crouch. He's one of our members, Permaculture Design Certified. He's got a great nursery down in the northern part of Kentucky, just near Cincinnati. And I visited his place and seen how he grows stuff. I've bought a lot of plant stock from him, and I'm really impressed both with his pricing and the fact that he's growing pretty much everything organically using compost that he's produced on his own farm. I was thrilled when he sent his first range of plants up to me and started taking stuff out of the pots to put it into the ground. And he's got worms in all of these potted plants. So I know that the stuff is healthy. I know that it's been well taken care of. I know that he's provided suitable nutrition to it. And I've had very little problem with any of his plants, you know, unless I've killed them by my own neglect, but certainly not a problem with any of the quality. So that's what I'd recommend that you would do is find a nursery like that within your region where you can go see the grower and, you know, understand how they manage their nursery and purchase plants from them. And, you know, Doug's done a great job of having lots of different varieties that he has grown for many years at his place. So I know that they're climate adapted. He's been doing his own production and grafting on certain stocks as well. So I have a real good degree of confidence with him as a grower and recommend that you try to find somebody like that within your region, as I said, where you can go see their practices and see how they do things. And not only is that then a good thing to do to know your grower, but you know, they're always going to have good tips for you as well. So I'll mention a little bit about education as we get towards the end of today's presentation. And you know, then you know, you can learn a lot from other growers as a result of visiting their sites. So here's the $64 million question. What plants are you going to grow? So for me, in choosing plants, my business is predominantly doing work for landscaping for my permaculture design customers. So with that, you know, I'm largely being shaped in plant selection by my design or by another designer's design. And, you know, my selections then for what I grow are largely dictated by that. But if you're looking to serve your local market, I've got some good general recommendations here. And, you know, as I expand my nursery production, I do want to sell a lot more stuff, like right in my hometown here in Adrian, Michigan. I want to be able to supply to the local nurseries and get large enough to do that. So I need to be able to meet a fairly wide range of plant products over time. So what I'm going to recommend is that you get yourself a good mix of perennials and annuals as your customers, whether it's for landscaping or whether it's, you know, somebody walking onto your nursery site, they're going to want both. Just like I do when I go to my local nursery here at Barrett's in Adrian, they've got a good range of fruit trees and other perennial plants, and they've got a massive stock that they always have every year of seed trays with annual vegetables. So you want to replicate that. So your annual staples, such as tomatoes, corn, squash, potatoes, broccoli, beans, cauliflower, peppers, those are your stock standard that I'd always recommend that you would grow. You can throw in things like melons where I'm located. That's a little bit of a challenge, you know, because some of the growing seasons for your longer season melons, it just won't fit within my frost-free period here in Michigan. Different herbs such as basil, rosemary, thyme, lemongrass, and sage are ones that, you know, sell particularly well. Seems like everybody uses those that's a gardener. Then if we look at perennial fruit trees, your standards are your apples, pears, peaches, plums, and cherries here in, you know, northern climates. If you're in the south, your warmer southern climates like in South Texas and, you know, across the Gulf Coast and into Florida, you can look at bananas and citrus and mangoes and papaya. I'm tinkering around the edges of getting several greenhouses built here. So I can look at growing some of those, tropical and subtropical fruits in passive solar heated greenhouses here. And again, I want to be able to have those things for my own use more than anything else. But I also want to show people how they can extend their seasons and extend their varieties on their own properties if they want to put in a greenhouse. The main thing is to look at chill hours for those plants that need a certain amount of dormancy. So chill hours is typically your temperatures between 32 and 45 degrees Fahrenheit. And certain varieties like peaches and apples and pears need certain amounts of chill hours. So if you're in Florida, the southern part of Florida might get 100 to 200 hours of chill each year. And so there are certain varieties of peaches and apples, et cetera, which are better suited for those climates. A lot of those have been developed by the University of Florida. And then you've got your apples such as your Dorset, Anna and Granny Smith are good ones to use in your warm climates. In cold climates like Michigan, certain parts of the state can get 1,400, 1,500 chill hours available. And you're better to stick to the varieties that are good for, you know, 1,000, 1,200. That's changing, it seems, from year to year. The climate can be unpredictable, as I mentioned earlier. So I'm starting to look at different varieties that might be able to be tolerant of only having 500, 600, 800 hours so that I can, you know, give myself some assurance of being able to produce depending on, you know, what changes occur to the climate in my location. Perennial berries. This is a great one to start with because they're smaller plants, a lot easier to manage in pots, and you can get varieties of pretty much every berry suited to almost any climate. So things like your blueberries, your raspberries, blackberries, mulberries, elderberries, and strawberries, literally hundreds of different varieties of each of those plants that are available. And like I said, can suit any climate all the way from Florida all the way through to the cold climates up in Canada. Perennial vegetables is a good thing to have. And, you know, I've actually created, a lot of simplicity to gardens by focusing on perennial vegetables. So things like asparagus, rhubarb, sunchokes or Jerusalem artichokes. I've got a perennial arugula, which just grows back every year from the roots. So I don't need to plant any arugula ever on my property. Multi-purpose plants. And these are ones that can act as pollinator attractors or animal deterrents and also provide food or medicine or improve your soil. So I got a few examples here of lavender, mint, black-eyed Susan, echinacea, calendula, poppies, comfrey, and clovers, you know, things that are going to provide those multiple functions within your permaculture garden. And they're also ones that, you can't normally get a lot of those things growing in nursery. comfrey. You know, there's maybe three or four producers, as I mentioned, in North America. I'm one of those that ships comfrey across the country. You know, it grows particularly well and easily. And so you want to look from a permaculture perspective, again, at, you know, what designs are being done and what plants are being included, and then selecting those plants that might not be readily available through your typical commercial nurseries. And then the last thing I'd suggest with, you know, your plant varieties is knowing what your cross-pollination requirements are. So the really quick ones are apples, pears, and cherries all require cross-pollination. So, you know your varieties and which ones will cross-pollinate each other so that you can make sure then, you know, for your customers that you're giving them good recommendations on what to grow so that they get good yields by having good cross-pollination. Okay, the last topic then is managing your business and your finances. You know, permaculture, nursery operations need to be profitable. Otherwise, why are you doing it? I mean, I love plants and I grow lots and lots of plants just for the heck of it. I like to experiment with what can grow in my location. But, you know, from a business perspective, you're doing this so that you can enhance your permaculture business if you're a designer and installer like I am. So first is know what your costs are and then determine your prices so that you can set yourself a good gross profit margin that, you know, gives you a good opportunity to earn income. But then also sets a price level that's reasonable in comparison to local nurseries. So I gave the example of when I started, you know, by buying plants at retail. I'm buying plants and I usually mark them up by 50%. And so that's a way that I can generate enough profit from the sales of plants to a customer on any specific project where I can cover a one-year replacement warranty that I offer to those customers. I'm responsible for planting all of those. And so, you know, I like to minimize my errors when I'm making my planting so that I'm not replacing, you know, tens or dozens of plants. Typically, I'm going to lose one, two, three plants out of a project in a year. And by marking up by 50%, that gives me, like I said, enough margin to cover the cost of that replacement plant. Plants that I'm growing, I set my prices comparable to other nurseries, and, you know, with seed grown plants as an example, you can get margins as much as 80 to 90%. So those annual vegetables and herb plants are going to be your most profitable. You know, if you're looking at, I like to give the example of lettuce, where you can buy a pack of lettuce seed, typically 300 seeds for under $5. You know, you can grow 300 lettuce seedlings and sell them for $4 or $5 for a pack of six. You know, you can do the math on that, and it works out to $250 roughly in sales for something that costs you $5 worth of seed, plus your time, plus your materials for growing. So you do the math on that, as I've done, and, you know, the margins work out, like I said, you know, typically 80 or 90% profitability on those opportunities. When I'm looking at just selling plants retail, I'm going to mark up by a lower amount, typically 30 to 40%, because that's probably adequate, and I'm not offering a warranty on those because I'm not responsible for planting and caring for those plants. So I can set a lower price and not have to worry about covering that one-year plant replacement warranty. I'm going to recommend that you start small until you learn what sells and what doesn't. And the corollary to this is to resist the temptation to have every plant that's available for your region. I've grown a lot of unusual plants for myself. Malabar spinach is being a good example. It's a great perennial in tropical areas, but it's not here. And so it requires a little bit of extra planning and forethought if you're going to grow a plant like that and get it into your customer's garden in time to actually produce a good crop. So I don't buy unusual plants unless it's for a specific customer project. And, you know, we agree that it's something that they want to mess with in terms of the extra care that might be needed for those plants. So my stock is typically pretty limited, to those standards that I've mentioned, your fruit trees, your berry bushes, et cetera, the things I'm going to sell all of every year. It's a typical 80-20 rule. Probably 80% of what you're going to sell is going to be 20% of the plants that might be available for your region. And then, the other 80% of plants that might be available will make up maybe 20% of your sales at most. The importance of this is, making sure that you can clear out your inventory as much as possible every year. Trying to manage plants across the winter in the northern climates and even in parts of the middle part of the country can be challenging, to provide the protection that's needed. Plants that are smaller, like your blueberries in, 1 or 2 year size pots, they can't really be protected adequately outdoors. So you need to get them into some kind of shelter, and that requires extra work. It requires extra management. So I recommend trying to clear out your inventory each year. And that is generally possible, again, if you don't have too many different varieties of unusual plants as part of your inventory. From a financial standpoint, managing that inventory becomes a tax feature that, if you can't claim the cost of inventory that you carry over. So trying to minimize that inventory at the end of the year reduces your tax, shall we say, complexity. And then my last tip about managing your business and your finances then is just to get training from others with experience. So over my time in two countries, probably lived in 30 or 40 different locations because of my engineering career. So I've had a lot of exposure to lots of different nursery growers and owners over the last 35 years. And, I always take the time to get to know them. These are the people who could be providing me with my food trees and other plants. And so, I always take the time to visit with them. How permaculture shaped my life was in Western Australia, especially as Jesse mentioned in the introduction, I met my local nursery grower. He was actually a Dutch guy who'd moved to Australia, married an Australian lady, and they'd set up a little tiny nursery on the main street of this little town that I lived in, and it was a permaculture-based nursery. And Hoddert, did a wonderful job looking after all of his plants. And, he would spend hours with me for free just to teach me, how plants grew, what worked in the climate, how to look after everything well. And so, that kind of free advice from your other nursery growers and operators is great resource for you to use in learning for yourself. I don't think there are too many plants being grown in nurseries in North America. We've experienced a lot of different shortages over the last few years. There's been certain events like deep south freezes that have killed out a lot of perennial plant inventory that's, reduced the availability of certain plants. During COVID, everybody was buying everything that they could to plant in their yards. And so, there's plenty of room in the swimming pool for everybody to swim when it comes to being a nursery grower. So from that perspective, I think you'll find there's a lot of nursery operators who are quite happy to help you start up your own business. Using the local example of Barrett's here in Adrian, I met with them to talk about giving a permaculture presentation that we did just 2 weeks ago. And started to meet with their nursery manager and their growers. And, I could probably set up to compete with them. And they won't care because they can't get enough plants for their nursery. And they'll actually ask me to be a grower for them, and store stock that they can't keep on their downtown property. So I think there are lots of opportunities to actually work in collaboration with your existing local nurseries and, find out what their needs are. They gave me the example that they can't keep enough lavender on their site. So they typically only keep 70 plants every year. And once those are gone, they can't get any more because they have to place their orders almost a year in advance for everything that they want to grow or have available for their customers. And there's been times where I could probably buy out their entire inventory. for some of my customers that want lots of lavender. So that's going to be an example of me where I could probably grow 400, 500 lavender plants a year and have that as available stock for them to draw from once they deplete the stuff that they purchase. So with that, that's, I guess, a good overview of, you know, five key areas of operating a nursery business and starting from scratch. So I want to thank everybody for attending today. The last thing I want to do is just mention that I'm also on the board of directors of Great Rivers and Lakes Permaculture Institute. So as Jesse said at the start, you know, this is being hosted by Pina. GRLPI is one of the regional hubs. And if you're within the six states within the Midwest Great Lakes region, please feel free to join us as well, because we have lots of good things going on in our local area.
All right. Thank you, Graham. That was great. So glad you mentioned what's the acronym? GRLPI.
GRLPI. Great Lakes Permaculture Institute.
Yeah, thank you. I need to join as I'm so local, and I will. And I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I didn't in the bio. This is a really great overview, and it gave, I think if you're just starting, if you're just getting excited by permaculture, this would be a fantastic narrowing down of the infinite possible choices and a really intelligent way to begin. I really appreciate your tip about talking to and not, and sort of like working together with local nurseries and finding out, you know, just being a friend of theirs, you're going to find out like, oh, there's a business opportunity just in the lavender or just in the this or just in the that. Just one question that came to mind. How did you, like when you did a permaculture presentation for your local nursery, was that to the nursery itself, the business, or was that to the town of Adrian hosted at the nursery? How did that work out?
Yeah, that worked out really well. So, yeah, I received one of their monthly newsletters because I buy stuff from them all the time. So I'm part of their Facebook group. And they made an announcement about a series of workshops that they were going to run over winter, you know, covering all kinds of different topics about indoor growing with plants, you know, what to plant during summer, et cetera. And so I wrote back to the lady who sent that out and said, hey, can I give a permaculture workshop? First question, what's permaculture? You know, conversation started. So in any event, I went and visited with them. We sat down, we talked about permaculture. This was me and my farm manager, Julia Fauti. We both go over there, had a great chat with them for an hour to an hour and a half, where we learned all of these things about their business. And we gave them the basic overview of permaculture and what we do within our business. So we then set up to do that. I think it was the last week of January on a Saturday morning, and they opened up the store for their customers to basically come in and hear about permaculture. They shared with us in the marketing activities for that, you know, posting all over Facebook and Instagram and, you know, other social media streams that we're all part of. Yep. We did joint publication of some of those social media launches. We had probably 25 or 30 people show up at 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning. And, you know, they hosted it with refreshments, you know, we gave the presentation, added them then afterwards to our email newsletter list. We've already had one initial consultation with one of the folks that showed up there and potential to do some support work with that customer afterwards. And we got four or five others still to set up, you know, folks that expressed interest in having a free initial consultation. So from a business perspective, it doesn't get any better when you've got a site like that that can host that type of opportunity. No sooner had I posted on Facebook that I was about to give that presentation, and then there's one of the young guys in the local area who's a friend of my kids, works at the other nursery in the area, and is a big greenhouse nursery. He said, hey, Graham, he said, can you come and give presentations to us as well? I'm like, yep, sign me up. So probably here in the next week, I'll be going to visit with the greenhouse managers for that operation and start talking about, you know, when we can do presentations in spring.
Perfect. That's a great model that anybody can really sort of follow. And, you know, even if people are familiar with permaculture, you can still offer a next level permaculture. But, you know, you're kind of offering like the introduction of permaculture, which is great. And you're drumming up clients for your consulting business, potential nursery clients, and you're helping foster the relationship between the nurseries locally. So I love that you're doing that. And thanks for that little nugget's really good. Hey, Graham, yeah. I have a question. And it's okay if you're not quite sure, but I'm thinking of somebody who might want to start getting a nursery library together, like a few key books. Are there any books that pop to mind as like, man, I would get this book or at least these two books or something like that?
Yeah, I've got over here on my left, and I can't turn around and show you. Well, actually, I probably can, but
Oh yeah, there you go.
you'll see right there, that's just my permaculture library. And so within that, I've got so many different topics covered. So it's really hard for me to pick out favorites. But from the perspective of being able to grow stuff for food production, or any of the books by Elliot Coleman are good ones. My favorite, probably permaculture book, which talks about growing lots of plants in a small space, is Paradise Lots. I think it's Tonsmeyer that
Yep,
wrote that
there we go.
one. And so that's probably one of the inspirational examples of a book that I read where I go like, oh my gosh, this is where you can actually do permaculture on a very, very small property and do stuff intensively. And he talks about, I think, within that book, the opportunities then to grow stuff and produce stock to sell to others, and he's done that, I guess, in different locations that he's lived at. So.
Yeah, I love that book. That's a book, by the way, if anybody's listening, that I would give to like my grandma or my mom or something who knew nothing about permaculture because it's really just a story. And I got to interview Eric and he actually said it's kind of a love story, actually, which really it is. There's a love story woven in there, like between humans, but then it's also a plant love story. And like you say, what you can do on a tiny little space. So I love that rec. Well, Graham, this has been so wonderful. Thank you again for all of your wisdom distilled down into this short presentation. It's been fantastic. How can people support you? How can they buy plants from you, get consults from you? Where would you point them?
Yeah, so my personal website, which covers my local farm business and my nursery operations, is permacultureadventuresmi.com. You go there, you can book a free consultation with me. I do cover all of North America when it comes to doing consultations because I've done design work in 70 different locations across probably 30 or 40 states. So I've got no problem at all traveling across North America to do that consultation work if it's needed. So go, to permacultureadventuresmi.com. If you want to see me on social media, I'm at Graham Towerton on Instagram. And so with that, those are probably the two best places to go see what I do. I'm also the Chief Operations Officer of Permaculture Canada, along with Lindsay Brandon. And you can see that website, permaculturecanada.world. And that's where you can see all of our design and consulting services there.
Cool. That's great. We'll have all the links in the show notes and that sort of thing so people can follow up. Thanks again, Graham. This has been wonderful. Thanks everybody for watching. I hope you had a good journey with us here today, and we'll see you on the next one. Take
Thanks,
care.
Jesse.
All right. Stick around for a second, Graham, if you
You
can.
bet.
I'm gonna stop the stream. So I tried to stream it and it worked. We had a couple people watching live on YouTube.
Awesome.
No questions, otherwise I would have thrown.